This week, the Anti-Defamation League released its annual audit of anti-Semitic incidents that have occurred, and the number, 8,873 incidents of assault, harassment, and vandalism are the highest in the ADL's recorded history. More than 5,000 of those incidents occurred after the October 7th terror attack on Israel and the ensuing Israel-Hamas war in Gaza. Welcome to The Sound of Ideas. I'm Jenny Hamill. We'll talk to the regional director of ADL Cleveland and a local rabbi about these anti-Semitic acts, and we'll talk about the impact this is having on the local Jewish community. Later, a conversation with one of the honorees of the Crane's Cleveland Business 8 over 80 list. And finally, an installment of our music podcast, Shuffle. Those conversations coming up. First, the news. It's The Sound of Ideas from IdeaStream Public Media. I'm Jenny Hamill. Good morning, and thanks so much for joining us. The Anti-Defamation League found a massive spike in anti-Semitic incidents in the United States in its annual audit that was released this week, reporting a total of 8,873 incidents of assault, harassment, and vandalism, with the majority of incidents, more than 5,000, occurring after the October 7th attack on Israel and the resulting Israel-Hamas war in Gaza. This total is the highest in the ADL's recorded history and is a 140% increase from 2022's number of incidents. There were almost 2,000 incidents targeting Jewish institutions such as synagogues, Jewish community centers, and Jewish schools, such as anti-Semitic bomb threats. The audit found that Ohio had 237 anti-Semitic incidents in 2023 compared to 61 in 2022. This includes at The Ohio State University, when two Jewish students were punched by assailants who asked if they were Jewish and made anti-Semitic comments. We're going to start today's show by talking about this audit and how these incidents are impacting the local Jewish community and others. Joining me for this conversation in studio is Kelly Fishman, Regional Director of ADL Cleveland, which includes Ohio, West Virginia, Kentucky, and Western Pennsylvania. Kelly, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
We also have Rabbi Robert Nosenchuk, founding senior rabbi of the new congregation Mishkan Or, that is a merger of two prominent Reform congregations in Northeast Ohio, Anshe Hesed Fairmount Temple and Temple Teferet Israel. Rabbi, thanks so much for coming in.
I'm glad to be here.
Thanks to you both. If you'd like to join the conversation, have a thought or a question, call 866-578-0903. You can email us at soi@ideastream.org, or you can tweet us. We're at Sound of Ideas. Kelly, the sheer increase of incidents when you look at a 10-year span to now is stunning. In 2014, there were around 900 incidents nationwide. Now it is almost 9,000 anti-Semitic incidents. But even before the Israel-Hamas war, that number has been rising steadily for the last few years. How would you characterize this increase?
Sure. So we're really seeing this increase in hate in general. It's as if it's become open season for hate. And so we're really seeing this increase across the board. And when we see this rise in anti-Semitism slowly over the years, we're also seeing that impact other communities within our region. And so it's people of color, the LGBTQ plus community, people with disabilities. And so my concern with this rise is that we're starting to see, especially white extremists and white nationalists, use this hate to silo people. And so if we are worried about our own identity markers and really trying to keep ourselves safe, it makes it very difficult for all of us to work together across the board to fight hate in general, because there is so much fear around whatever those identity markers are for us.
And Kelly, obviously the Israel-Hamas war plays a huge part in the increase in incidents of recent in the country. Part of the conversation since the war began has been about what is anti-Semitic and what is critical of the Israeli government's actions in Gaza, which many people, including Jews, would say has led to a grave humanitarian crisis for residents in Gaza. Can you talk about how the ADL defines what makes an anti-Semitic incident?
Sure. So we utilize the IHRA, International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance, definition of anti-Semitism. And that really focuses on when we target a specific group of people based on their Jewish identity. And so if that means that that person supports Israel and we are criticizing that person who may or may not live in Israel, and we're using that identity marker as a way to marginalize them, that's when we really see that as anti-Semitism. So we have to be really careful, because you can be critical of the Israeli government. Just like in the United States, there is not one person in our country who has agreed with every single decision a president has made. It doesn't make us any less American. And so understanding that we can live in the and, that we can disagree with the choices the Israeli government is making and believe that Israel still has a right to exist and that the people who live there should not be wiped off the face of the earth because of their Jewishness. And so that's really where we look at that line.
And Rabbi, I see you nodding your head.
Yes. It's people who pay special attention to Israeli policy in their activism are not necessarily anti-Semitic. But when they almost always choose Israel as a focus of their efforts, when they single Israel out among many other nations, when they ignore the plight of hundreds of hostages and press forward terms like Nazis and lumping Jews and Zionists all together, that is inherently anti-Semitic. I was not long ago at an interfaith forum where a questioner asked each of the faith leaders to consider stepping aside from one of their controversial positions for the sake of peace. And of course, they had a specific ask for each of the faith leaders. In my case, it was, would I be willing to set aside my Zionism? I rejected that proposal because it's a core to my faith. It's an essence of my faith. We are a people Israel. That doesn't mean that we don't have compassion on this horrible situation of war that's happening, but it's not true peace. Not true dialogue if we're not speaking our truths to each other. And that's what I seek to engender with people of all faiths and all values regarding the Israel conflict.
Rabbi, we mentioned record incidents in Ohio, including anti-Semitic bomb threats aimed primarily at Jewish synagogues. As someone who works and leads practicing Jews, can you discuss the atmosphere you feel as well as the congregants in this current landscape?
I wish that the congregants of my community and throughout the Jewish community, when they read the ADL's audit, would feel that it was not in sync with what they're experiencing. My goodness, I pray for a day where people feel that this is not related to the kind of experiences they're having every day, the kind of experiences of having allies or friends walk away from dialogue with them, the things that are happening to students on college campuses, including at Ohio State and others here in Ohio. But I have the youngest child in my household. We just finished touring colleges. They're about to graduate high school. And while I have a great deal of confidence that they will be able to address anti-Semitism and see it on its face, I have sincere doubts as to whether or not the administrators, educators, and university presidents will have their back. And that makes me greatly concerned.
And Kelly, does this reflect in the audit as well? Do you study the impact it's having on the psyche of the Jewish community nationwide?
Yeah, we're really looking at the incidents that come into us, whether they're reported by our constituents or coming in from law enforcement or the media. And, you know, we're seeing the impact across the board from our youngest students in K to 12 schools all the way up through the workplace. So when some of the incidents in Ohio include, and I, just a trigger warning here with the language, but, you know, an elementary school student saying all the Jews in Israel should die, and a middle school student saying kill all the Jews, this is happening in our schools. And so we know, you know, as a former educator, I know that when students don't feel safe in the classroom, they cannot learn. And so when that kind of language, the idea that an elementary school student or a middle school student would say that someone deserves to die, you don't have to be part of that identity group to feel that fear as well, because that's scary, especially as a young student. And so we have to be better about educating our students and our community members, because this impact on psyche and emotion is going to affect not just the Jewish community, but everyone who sees these acts of violence, such as vandalism or harassment. It impacts all of us.
And there's also those who attend, children who attend Jewish daycares, yeah, or go to the JCC, who also might be affected by this. Rabbi, in Cleveland, the broader Northeast Ohio region, there are many Jews, a big Jewish community. Many of those don't outwardly appear Jewish, but then there are those who wear a yarmulke, a Star of David, or present as Jewish in more optic, obvious ways. Have congregants who present as Jewish talked about anti-Semitic interactions they've had in public? Are they fearful of wearing a yarmulke or a Star of David in public?
I would say that I'm hearing from people across the board that they're experiencing anti-Semitism if they identify as Jews or with Jewish causes vocally, or, as you indicated, in some apparently obvious visual way. The Jewish community is very diverse. The biggest growing population within the Jewish community actually is Jews of color. And so those folks, too, who are of color, are experiencing anti-Semitism and reporting it to me. But I will say that there is a reverse effect that I'm seeing among people in many generations. That is to say, people wish to act in defiance of the haters. I'm seeing more Star of David necklaces, more bracelets and T-shirts and caps that remind people that we are we have a sense of purpose and vision about healing the world, and we won't be cowered into a corner. Our synagogues, of course, we have to be mindful of the legitimate existential threats. My goodness, we've had bomb threats at pretty much all of the synagogues, either via phone or email, but we have taken steps to secure and to deter those who might be threatening us. But one of the reasons and one of the things that I'm excited about in the new congregation we're forming, Congregation Mishkan Or, is that we have an opportunity now to retool and reframe our education, both to acknowledge the rising threats of anti-Semitism and hate, especially hatred against all peoples. But at the same time, we have to act in defiance of the haters. One of the best ways that we can respond to anti-Semitism is not to shrink our commitment to Jewish life, Jewish values, and our love and care for one another. That's why I say it's really important for people to realize that Judaism doesn't just allow, but demands us to have compassion for more than one people at a time, because there certainly can be more than one people who are hurting deeply, such as those in Gaza versus those sitting on the Israeli side of the border, wondering if they'll ever see their loved ones again.
Let's take a call from Alex in Rocky River. Alex, good morning. Thanks for calling in.
Good morning. Can you hear me okay?
I can hear you perfectly. Thanks.
Yeah. Yes. So my question for anybody on the panel this morning, I'm actually Jewish myself, so I'm curious. What are the numbers in regards to anti-Semitic incidents in Greater Cleveland. I'll let the panelists define that region as they may, the counties that comprise what we would consider to be Northeast Ohio. I know that you hear in the news generally that anti-Semitism is on the rise. And obviously these incidents anywhere are unacceptable. I'm just curious, how big of a problem is it in Greater Cleveland, Northeast Ohio? I'll let the panelists define that however they wish.
Thanks, Alex, for the call. Do we have numbers that are specific to the region, Kelly?
We look specifically at the states. And so I can tell you that at the state level, we've seen a 367% increase in harassment in Ohio, an 89% increase in vandalism. And we went from zero assaults last year to two assaults in Ohio. And so I will say anecdotally, things in Northeast Ohio are a little bit better than when we move into central and southern Ohio. And part of that is based on some of the white extremist activity that we see happening in central and southern Ohio. And if you go to the ADL website, you can learn more about some of that activity. But I would say the bomb threats are the ones that are really impacting us here in Northeast Ohio, because it impacts so many of our synagogues and Jewish institutions.
Kelly, I would point as well, though, to the outspoken leadership of law enforcement and Mayor Bibb and other leaders of multiple areas in Northeastern Ohio, letting people know that all forms of hatred will be held accountable, not just the feeling of it, but acting on it. Because even the Kelly spoke of two assaults, those are two reported assaults.
Right.
There are many other people who have experienced assaults and have declined to report it either to law enforcement or to the ADL because they fear retribution. And it's not a surprise, because we're living in a climate where people are indifferent when politicians running for president start claiming Jews are disloyal if they oppose me. Jews need to be spoken to if they are questioning anything about one side or another of politics. This is not about the politics, but it's about the indifference so many people have made. And I think that setting that climate, retooling it, and making it holding all of our leaders accountable to the kind of standards that we're asking for here, That helps reassure people. It helps people know and understand. Last year in April, we had a electrical fire that nearly destroyed our temple building, Fairmount Temple. Thank goodness law enforcement and public safety officials and fire squads were right on the scene and helped us put out the fire. But the visual of billowing black clouds of smoke coming out of our synagogue, which has since been almost entirely repaired. But that scene on the last day of Passover in Beechwood, Ohio, instantly had thousands of people on edge because they were absolutely certain that it could be an act of anti-Semitism. It turns out it was not, there was no foul play, but my goodness, we're living in 2024. We shouldn't fear that someone's going to come torch our synagogue on Passover. Passover's coming up just in a couple of days, and the whole message is one of trying to redeem those who are oppressed and fight hatred.
Kelly, the report talked a lot about anti-Israel or anti-Zionist protests. Of course, and I do feel like we need to revisit the issue, because there are a lot of passionate people who are probably listening right now who are supportive and sympathetic to the plight of the people in Gaza, who may share views they don't consider to be anti-Semitic, but they're joining in and saying, from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free. But that phrase has historical context that in the ADL's mind does indeed make it an anti-Semitic comment. Can you explain that to us?
Sure. So for ADL and for most Jews, the term from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free, is the idea that Israel would be wiped off the map. And so it's important to understand the impact of our language. So when you say something, your intent may not be to hurt someone, right? I think that almost everyone would agree that they want the Palestinian people to be able to live in safety, right? And not be under the control of a terrorist organization like Hamas, to not be experiencing war, but at the same time to argue that that means that Israel does not then have a right to exist becomes anti-Semitic when Israel is the largest place for Jews in the world. And so if, in contrast, if someone says freedom for Palestine, we do not consider that anti-Semitic, right? ADL argues for a two-state solution for both Palestinians and Israelis. But we have to be really careful that our intent and our impact, that we're thinking about both of those, because we might say something that our intention is not to hurt someone, but the impact might be then that we do hurt them. And so we have to acknowledge that and say, you know what, I didn't realize that this phrase was really troubling for you, and I'm not going to say that anymore. I believe that Israelis and Palestinians both have a right to exist safely and freely, and I'm going to change my language to freedom for Palestine, right, or a free Palestine. And in an idea that we're not saying that Israel doesn't have a right to exist, because that's when we move into anti-Semitism.
Rabbi, do you feel that the American Jewish community at large, and of course it's not a monolith, but do you think, as a journalist, it does feel like there's such a conflation right now with what's happening in Gaza and where the Jewish community stands. Do you think there is enough being done for the Jewish community to say, here is where we stand when it comes to a humanitarian crisis, when it comes to the war? But again, it is not a reflection of every Jew in the United States.
I'm confused a little bit as to how to best answer the question.
Let me rephrase it. How would you, as a rabbi, when approached about what someone perceives as the horrors of the war, how do you place your position while also showing empathy for the pains being caused?
Thank you for clarifying. I think that being in a rabbinic position enables us, or any faith leader, to probe a little further, to approach someone with a attitude of curiosity rather than judgment, so that, let's say, on the way to asking that good question, they veer into the area Kelly just warned about, maybe asking them to clarify a bit so that we can get to a more constructive basis. In other words, where they may not be assuming that Jews are indifferent to the plight of Palestinian children. The truth is that overwhelmingly, Jews in America support not just a free Palestine, but the notion of a secure Palestine that lives in peace next to Israel and among other peaceful nations. That is not the message we can blare our horns with at the moment, because frankly, the world is neglecting to lift up, and especially, and I don't mean to target you in a journalistic position, but there are so many journalists who keep failing to include the fact that Israel repeatedly offers offers ceasefires, and during those ceasefire proposals, many hundreds of prisoners to be let out for the sake of very much innocent hostages. Let my people go is the words we sing so proudly when we are gathered around our Passover Seders, which begin this Monday evening in our families. And this year, it feels disastrously resonant with the world that is neglecting the plight of hostages. I mean, people's lives are defamed. Many traumatized women in the Middle East who have spoken out and clarified the way that they've been mutilated or sexually assaulted, their stories not being told. By the way, I'm sure that there are some overreaches on the part of Israelis who are fighting in the war. And I have confidence that Israel can withstand both that criticism and act on it to hold accountable any overreaching measures that have taken, because it is really very difficult to see the images of war. I think Jews are familiar with war, but as much as we are, we're familiar with it as part of the American milieu, and so many people they miss the sense that in war it's hell on earth for everybody involved.
Absolutely. Kelly, I want to ask you this because we are getting to a point where Holocaust survivors, we don't have many of them left. I mean, that's just a truth. And because of this delicate time and this inflamed period of perception, how does the ADL view remembering the Holocaust and preserving its memory and the impact it's had on Jews all over the world and here in the country?
Sure. So at ADL, we have an excellent program called Echoes and Reflections that really focuses on Holocaust education. As we head into Yom HaShoah in April and remembering the end of the Holocaust and really thinking about the impact that that had on thousands and thousands of people. I mean, millions of Jews were murdered in the Holocaust, along with other identity groups as well, which many people don't realize. And we are in this time of increased Holocaust denial. And as we're losing the voices of the people who survived that atrocity, I think we're finding it harder to counter that narrative when those voices don't exist. Mm-hmm. And it does such a disservice to the memory of the millions of people who were lost during that time, people in the LGBTQ plus community, the Romani community, the Jewish community. So many people were lost. And, you know, the fact that we're seeing people use Holocaust denial as a way to justify their actions, whether they're anti-Semitic or racist or homophobic or transphobic, is really shocking. And to see language like Hitler was right, I mean, to know that we do still have Holocaust survivors and we have people using that kind of language, I mean, how incredibly hurtful and painful for those people and for their families, right? And so we really have to do a better job of educating people about the Holocaust. We do not have mandatory Holocaust in all 50 states, Ohio being one of them. And so while many of our students do learn about the Holocaust, it is not a mandatory requirement for education in Ohio. And so when we miss that opportunity, there are students who aren't being exposed to that education or to that history.
This is a great concern to me. I'm the grandchild of a Holocaust survivor. My grandma Esther survived the Holocaust and came to this country as a refugee at 17 years old. She was born the same year as President Nelson Mandela of South Africa, who once wrote that people must learn to hate. If they can learn to hate, they can be taught to love. Love comes more naturally to the human heart than its opposite. And Mandela wasn't proposing love on the precondition of sacrificing our values, standing up for who we are. And that's the kind of emphasis, secular as well as Jewish, that I try and bring into Holocaust education in my synagogue. We distribute to every member family candles so that they can observe the Holocaust Remembrance Day coming forward and really single out some of the lives that they recall and remember.
Rabbi, I'm so sorry we've run out of time, but I appreciate ending on that note. Rabbi Robert Nosenchuk, founding senior rabbi of the new congregation, Mishkan Or, thank you so much for coming in. And of course, Kelly Fishman, regional director with ADL Cleveland. I appreciate your time and this important conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
We're going to take a quick break. When we return, I'm going to talk to one of the honorees of the 8 over 80 list offered up by Crane's Cleveland Business. That's when we return. You're with the Sound of Ideas from IdeaStream Public Media. I'm Jenny Hamill. Thanks for staying with us. Crane's Cleveland Business this month named outstanding older adults with incredible lives and careers who are continuing to make an impact in their community in its annual 8 over 80 awards. On Tuesday, we met 81-year-old philanthropist Ron Harrington, who discussed his career funding medical discoveries and institutes around the world. Today, we'll meet another member on the list, 83-year-old Betty Smith, who co-founded the nonprofit Enrichment that offers music and arts-based classes as well as life skills classes to children in Stark County. This conversation is pre-recorded, so we can't take calls, but please send your thoughts to soi@ideastream.org. Here's our conversation. Betty Smith, welcome to The Sound of Ideas.
Thank you very much for having me.
First, I'd like to say congratulations on the honor, and I'm wondering, how did it feel when you found out you made Crane's 8 over 80 list?
You know, I was ecstatic. When you get my age, I mean, things coming at you like that just seems like, oh, I'm heaven on earth.
I love it. Now, you were born in Indiana. You started working in Chicago in public service, working for Catholic Charities. Can you talk about your early career, where you were working to create a safe home for women and mothers to get recovery support from drugs and alcohol?
Yes, I was working with Catholic Charities, and it came to my attention that there was a need for a recovery home for women and women with children recovering from drugs and alcohol. And at the time, I had a daughter who was on drugs, and I didn't really know what to do. Hmm. And I was told there were not enough facilities available, and most of the women would just be in the streets. So I just felt like I had a calling to do something about it, even though I didn't know anything about, you know, the world of drugs. But a long story short on that, I was able to convince my employer, Catholic Charities, to find me a convent and give it to me. And I mean give it to me. Mm-hmm. And because I didn't have any dollars and I'd have to raise all the money, which I was able to do. So I was able to get a 38-bed convent, and I got a lot of different donors and churches, and people became very interested in what I was doing because the need was so great, and they helped furnish it. Some of the young ladies were on the Oprah show. They contacted me and said Oprah heard about a recovery home, and she wanted to do a show, and so some of my ladies were on it. And then the thing that really kind of blew me away was one day I went into my office, and Halle Berry was there.
Wow.
And Halle. And I was like, who is this? And she said, oh, I hope it's okay that I'm here. And I said, of course. She said, I'm getting ready to do a movie called Losing Isaiah. And she said, I was told to come to you to do some research. And I hope it's okay. And I said, of course. So we did. She stayed with us off and on for a couple of weeks. The ladies helped redo the script and the play. And in the first part, the movie, and the first part of the movie, some of the ladies from my home are in that movie. And my name and the name of my recovery home, which I call Forever Free, is in the credits of that movie. My name was Bip McDaniel then. And that was a highlight.
Wow. That is
recovery home.
That is so fascinating.
Yes.
So I hear that you are still in touch with some of these women 30 years later that you were able to help and support.
Yes, I am. It's just such a blessing that we've kept in touch. Thank God for social media, for Facebook. And that's why we're still in touch with one another. I mean, their children, their grandchildren. And it's just wonderful. And they just continuously say, thank you for saving my life. Because some of these women were really headed, you know, when you do drugs, they say, think of death. Because some of them do die from ODing and everything like that. So it's just wonderful to be in touch with them and to know that the recovery home in Chicago called Forever Free was able to make a difference in their lives.
Now, you came to Ohio with your late husband, Mark Smith.
Yes.
Or because of him, he was a Canton-based minister. What brought the two of you together?
Well, we met at a church retreat. And we met in 1991 at the retreat. Well, I was in the process of putting together the recovery home, so I really didn't have time to talk to him. Mm-hmm. So he quit calling me. And it was 7 years later I received a nice little note, and it said, do you remember me? And he talked about the retreat, and he said, I'd love to come and take you to dinner. Well, a long story short on that is he ended up proposing to me. It's like we'd known one another forever.
Wow.
And that was in, like, February of 98. We got married, had a huge church wedding in April of 98, and I moved to Canton.
a couple months later.
Yes.
That's incredible.
I said that was in divine order. That was God who put us together. And I've been in Canton ever since.
And there in Canton, you founded Multi-Development Services of Stark County. What was it like seeing children benefit from having a place to go and be creative?
Oh, yes. Multi-development was really wonderful. I was in a neighborhood that I really was not familiar with in Canton, and come to find out I was in probably one of the worst neighborhoods in Canton. We had drugs. We had prostitution. We had gangs. We had 450 boarded up houses, and the list was endless. And I remember going and introducing myself to the mayor, and he said, "Well, where are you?" And I told him, he said, "Oh, that's one of the worst neighborhoods ever." Mm. I said, "Well, then that's why I'm there." I said, "My husband's church is there, and I'm going to do some outreach." So I founded Multi-Development Services. Well, it started out being Minority Development Services of Stark County, but we have such a diverse population. My board said, "Let's call it Multi-Development Services Stark County." And I had a program for the youth. I always love working with the youth. Mm-hmm. And so I had about 50 youth that would come after school every day. They would come there. We'd have music. We'd have arts and crafts. In the summer, we had sports. I took them swimming. They learned to play golf and soccer. It was wonderful. But I also worked with the mothers, with children, similar to what I did in Chicago. Although I didn't have a recovery home, I would refer them to the recovery home that was already here in Canton. So my thing was keeping that family together was so very important to me. So you've got to work with the children. You have to work with all of them. And you help them to do that bonding, which is key in families. So that was Multi-Development Services of Stark County.
And in 2012, you start the nonprofit Enrichment, which is also focused on music and arts programs for children. You started it with three of your friends, and it began in your husband's church. So can you talk about the drumline and other ways the program helps young people?
Oh, yes, most definitely. Like you said, we started in my husband's church. In 3 months, we outgrew it. It was too small. So then we moved into a larger church, which was just about 3 or 4 blocks away. And we had, at that time, we had formed an orchestra. I had strings, wow. I had violins, violas, cellos. Then we had the strings. We had strings, we had woodwind. So we had like a 30-piece orchestra. And I patterned it after a program out of Venezuela called El Sistema. And these were a lot of underserved children in Venezuela that learned how to play instruments, but they made them out of, you know, tin cans and buckets and wood and stuff. And so that's how I had the orchestra. Well, it was like 2 years later, the young people said, "We want to learn how to play the drums." Well, needless to say, the drums took over. Everybody wanted to play drums. I lost my orchestra, and the drum line was formed. Although we kept other classes, you know, we had our art class, and we had other things going on. But the drum line became so powerful. And it still is. It's the thing that really drives the organization because they have 30-plus performances a year. I mean, the kids are everywhere. They do the Grand Parade. We're the only drumline in the Grand Parade in Canton. And they do the Hall of Fame. In fact, we do the Hall of Fame parade, not parade, but the Hall of Fame marathon in Cleveland. They go to Akron. 1 year I took them to Chicago. So they're just kind of known everywhere, and we continue to build the drum line. But the other programs are also growing, and one of our favorite classes now is cooking. The children are learning how to cook healthy meals, food we can get from the food bank, food that moms can buy with their SNAP cards, and they're healthy. I really dwell on being healthy with the children. Teaching them how to not eat so much junk food, not so much sugar, but to learn to eat fruits and vegetables. So what we do now, we have a garden.
Wow.
So they grow their vegetables and their herbs, and then from that they cook. So that's very, very popular. We also have a media class, and we have a theater. We do a couple of plays a year.
So, Betty, you're 83 years old. I don't get the sense that you have any inclination to stop helping, and I know that you're working with the kids now. What keeps you going rather than just kind of laying back and maybe, kicking back, you know, and thinking about all the hard work you've already done.
You know what? The children inspire me and motivate me. I love working with those children, and I see lives change right before my eyes. I see some of these children come in very broken, very down, upset, angry, and within weeks sometimes, I see new life come into those children because they feel loved. They see that we're genuine in what we do for them. They trust us, which is important. You have to win the trust of the children. And they stay with me a long time. Last summer, half of my summer camp staff were kids that grew up in the program. They were now seniors in high school or juniors and seniors in college, and several of them had graduated college, came back to work with us in the summer. So that's very rewarding. That motivates me, inspires me, keeps me going, and I just feel like this is what God wants me to do.
Well, I love it. And I want to know, what if someone's listening and is wondering, how can I help? How can I be a helper in the community? What advice would you give?
Oh, yes. You know, we always need volunteers. We never have enough volunteers to work with our children. And they can call 330-546-7724, or they can go to our website. Or we're on all social media. We're on Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, and it's Enrichment of Stark County. We can always use donations, and we can always use instruments, whether they're new or used. We get people to fix them for us. But volunteerism is very important, very key to our program, and we would welcome anyone that would like to come and volunteer.
Well, Betty Smith, I appreciate you speaking with me about your life and career, and congratulations again. Well deserved.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I'm very honored and blessed.
That was Betty Smith, one of this year's Crane's 8 over 80 honorees. Several Northeast Ohio jazz players are creating a lab to test new music and attract composers from near and far. On this week's Shuffle, IdeaStream Public Media's Amanda Rabinowitz has more about the Third Law Collective.
The pandemic separated people, particularly musicians, when clubs went dark. When things reopened, jazz bassist Aidan Plank knew he wanted to collaborate with others.
My idea was that it would be so helpful for me personally just to have a group of people to write for.
So Plank got together with a slew of area jazz musicians, flute player Brian Kennard, who moved back to Cleveland during the pandemic, guitarist Dan Bruce, and sax players Chris Coles, Brad Wagner, and Howie Smith. Together, they formed the Third Law Collective. The group began a residency at the Bop Stop in Cleveland, where Brian Kennard is the director.
So we've been doing a monthly show the last Thursday of every month at the Bop Stop, highlighting the composers both in the band and also other composers in town.
We'll often play the same pieces over many months, so you kind of hear what works and what doesn't work. My hope is eventually that this Third Law thing widens and widens to embrace like a whole community of jazz composers in the region. It would be really nice if Cleveland had this kind of reputation as being like a jazz composer's city.
Brian, what are your thoughts on this whole community aspect?
I completely agree. I mean, giving musicians sort of a lab band to work with to bring their music in and be able to have it heard. It would be awesome to bring in more guest artists to do sort of clinic work with younger musicians, younger composers.
I want to talk about the name of the group, Third Law Collective, based on Sir Isaac Newton's Third Law of Motion.
I kind of view composers as the object in motion. We are always inspired by other composers that have come before or other composers that are around us. So in my view, we are being acted upon by these other forces that always are pushing us in other directions. So much like the third law of motion, staying in motion and being impacted by another force, I feel like it fit the kind of idea of this ensemble where the musicians in the group are interested in being pushed by other composers.
Do you want to talk about a couple of the pieces that you've been performing? Brian, you want to start?
Yeah, I'll start. One of the pieces that I wrote for the ensemble was initially inspired by these walks that I took with my wife during the pandemic. So it's entitled Walk With Me, just kind of a little adventurous exploration of how I can take a small collection of pitches and see how many different ways I can manipulate that and create a piece. We've been playing this great, challenging piece by Howie Smith entitled Off the Mark, which is kind of a blues in 11 and really explores the number 11 throughout the entire piece.
Do you want to talk about a piece or two?
I guess one piece I like, I hope this isn't self-indulgent, but it's one of my pieces. It's called the Grand Arch of Nothingness,
wow.
Which is a bit bleak. But it's an experimental piece, so instead of using conventional notation of notes on a staff, music staff, the instructions are all in text, and it reads like kind of a cooking recipe.
How do you mean it reads like a recipe?
Well, the one way we convey what we're trying to get musicians to do is to notate using notes on the staff with conventional rhythm. So play this pitch at this time and in this rhythm. You can write a piece of music that doesn't follow those parameters, so just write out a text which will say, play something loud, play something soft. I have instructions in my piece like listen and try to match a pitch with someone else's pitch and things like that. It's something that was really, I don't want to say it was exhausted in the classical world, because there are still composers that do this, but I find actually the jazz world is a really unique place for experimental music, because jazz musicians are really incredibly willing to improvise and not know what's going to happen.
The experimental side of this whole thing. I want to talk, Brian, a little bit about how the Bopped Stop plays into all of this, because you are the director there, and this has kind of been a home space for this group.
Yeah, well, the Bopped Stop has always been kind of a home for creative musical thought throughout its history. In taking over the Bopped Stop, I was really interested in kind of moving those ideas forward and kind of perpetuating this idea of the Bopped Stop being home for original creative music. Again, this third law was something that I wanted to really promote, find a way to start building this community around original music for large ensembles. And there really are no other groups doing this regularly in town.
And you still perform there monthly?
Yes. Every month, the last Thursday of every month, except for this month. This month, we've got a special performance that we're doing on Saturday, April 27th. We're doing a live recording session.
So tell me how that came to be.
We decided that we've been playing this music for a year. We were looking to some opportunities to put together kind of a special way to document some of the music that we've been performing regularly, but also challenge ourselves to maybe write some new music. And we're bringing in a guest artist, a great trumpet player, Russ Johnson.
Aidan, that must be such a wonderful feeling knowing that you've gotten to this point where you're going to be taping a live performance. Must be exciting.
You know, my anticipation is that it'll be really, I don't want to make this too big of a deal, but, maybe a nice moment in the history of Cleveland jazz and creative music. And my hope personally is that this will be the first of many documents of this sort.
So you're going to do this on the 27th. What's the future of Third Law Collective?
We'll continue the last Thursday performances through the year, and we'll keep writing new music. I've had a few other composers in town reach out, so we'll probably start reading some new music in May and June. I would love to see this kind of grow, perhaps form a nonprofit status and start to build some educational programming along with the performance side of it, creating this kind of hub for creative composition.
There's two things I'd like to see happen, and one is really creative jazz musicians and jazz composers would actually seek out Third Law and would want to come to Cleveland to interact with Third Law. The other thing I'd really love to see happen is these last Thursdays of the month also became something that wasn't just purely about the experience of jazz composers honing their craft, but also was a place where people enjoyed just coming to hang out and experience some really amazing new music. Sometimes some really amazing new music completely flop. Sometimes something go really successfully, and just kind of being there and taking part in all of that. That's something I would love to see happen too.
Thank you both so much. We're looking forward to that live recording on the 27th, and I'm hoping to catch one of these Thursday nights at the Bob Stop. Thank you both for being here.
Thank you.
That's Aidan Plank and Brian Kennard of the Third Law Collective. You can find links and follow the podcast at ideastream.org/shuffle. I'm Amanda Rabinowitz, IdeaStream Public Media.
Shuffle is your backstage pass to Northeast Ohio's independent music scene. And that wraps it up for our show. Tomorrow on The Sound of Ideas, it's the Friday Reporters Roundtable with guest host IdeaStream Marlene Harris-Taylor. We will talk to you next week. It's Earth Week, so we're going to have a lot of environmental topics. For now, I'm Jenny Hamill. Thanks so much for listening. We'll speak with you again on Monday.